From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I get to chat with sound designer Andrew Hobson, and then Matthew Sosi joins us for an interview with Duke Tomato about his new album.
Then I'll get a preview of the three new National Geographic exhibits at the Children's Museum of Indianapolis with Jeff Patchen. Plus, there's our arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR.
You experience the art of sound designers every time you see a movie, TV show, or play. Sharon Gamble was curious about how someone decides to become a sound designer and what sorts of skills are needed. So she invited Andrew Hobson, a local sound designer with a national portfolio, into our studios to tell her more.
I have to say I'm a little intimidated interviewing a sound designer. You know this equipment better than I. This is what you work with. How did you get interested in being a sound designer?
It was complete dumb luck, in fact. I was approached when I was studying composition at Butler University. I was approached to write music for a show by one of the theater faculty there. And I said, sure, I'd love to. So we did it, and we had a wonderful time as me writing music for her show, and she asked me to do another show.
What was the show? What was the first one?
The first one was called Caucasian Chalk Circle.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then we did, it's Night Must Fall. First show was Night Must Fall, and then we did Caucasian Chalk Circle together. And some point during the second show, she was talking, she said, oh, I knew I wanted to use you when I heard that trombone piece you wrote. And internally, I was saying to myself, I didn't write that. Andrew Simpson wrote that.
So, but you didn't reveal all at the moment.
I kept
smart.
That secret.
So the way to get into a career as a sound designer is deviousness.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Good to know. you were studying composition, and my sense is that there might be some people who go into that career path thinking, no, I'm going to be a pure composer. I'm only going to write music for performance in stage,
and
classical,
that was my
concert
original
halls.
Plan.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But there has that had to have been kind of fun. I want you to compose something for a play. What was that process like?
Well, it's very different because if you're a concert composer, you essentially have no restrictions other than what the ensemble performing is. But for plays, you have dozens of restrictions. But the advantage is you're working with something. So, for example, if I see a scene, I can look at the scene and I will know immediately what kind of music, what instruments need to be played. And all those decisions are, even though I'm theoretically making them, in my brain, there's no other choice. So that greatly simplifies the process. Also, you get to work with people, which is a lot of fun. You actually are seeing what you do with lights, with actors, with costumes, with a set, and it all comes together and creates a much more compelling vision image than if it was just the music by itself.
How much give and take was there in that initial project? I assume you probably read the script many times and talked with the director about, well, what kind of mood do you want here, or here's what I'm thinking, and then you maybe demonstrated it on a keyboard or a synthesizer or something. How did it work?
Yeah, that was basically that. We would go through the script together. I would sit in rehearsals and make tons and tons of notes and then come back and bring cassettes, remember those?
Oh, yeah.
of the material to her, and we would listen to it and see what worked and what didn't. Now, this was a little bit different than what I do now because I actually had an orchestra on stage with me. So I was writing changes and handing them to the players, and they would actually play the music during the show.
What a luxury.
It was.
Wow. And so one thing led to another. So you did a couple of plays at Butler. And then how did you well, maybe you haven't decided. Maybe you are still writing for strictly concert performance. Are you doing some of that composing?
No, not really.
No?
Just shows.
Yeah. How do you build a career doing that?
For me, it was following the path of least resistance. It was a case of sort of when a door opened, I would just walk through it, not knowing what would be on the other side. So I studied composition at Butler, got my master's here, got my doctorate at Minnesota. And while I was working at Minnesota, I began working for the music department as a recording engineer, and I got hooked up with the people at Minnesota Public Radio. So a lot of what I learned through the engineers at NPR.
Certainly a top place to learn.
Yes. Yeah. It was very helpful.
Well planned, sir. Mm-hmm. So is your doctorate in composition?
Yes. All of my formal training is in music.
Is it possible to get a degree specifically in composing for theater?
Not for theater particularly, but for film.
There are
huge film scoring programs out on the West Coast. But there are also several, well, now I think there's 10 master's programs in sound design throughout the country. So we study, there you study acoustics, you study system design, you study creating sound effects, but you also study music and a lot of composition. I have a program at Indiana University where I teach all of that, plus a lot of ethnomusicology. We watch lots of films and work on shows together to make sure that, you know, they know what's going on before we send them out in the real world.
What has changed the most? I have to say it's radio, so people have really no idea how old you are.
Sure.
Still pretty early in your career. You're still pretty young. But even in the span of the few years you've been working, there have to have been some big changes. Technology changes.
Computers.
You blink and everything has changed.
Yeah, it's all computers now. It was all reel-to-reel when I started, reel-to-reel tape. And then we moved to mini disc and digital audio tape, and then finally computers. I used to build all of my shows on reel-to-reel tapes, playing my sound effects off of the BBC LP collection of sound effects.
Cool.
Now all that's instantly downloadable, and I keep a hard drive full of, you know, tens of thousands of sound effects available.
You know, if there isn't, there should be a support group of people who remember open reel editing. I have an acquaintance who was said back in that day that she could edit out the second S from the word harassment on open reel. And that is no mean thing to
do. Using
a razor blade and tape. Yeah. So I know you've worked you've written for television, for film, for documentaries, mm-hmm. for live theater. How different are those processes?
Well, live theater, there's a lot of give and take. What I write, the actors will respond to, and often you'll watch an actor, say, deliver a monologue without an underscore, and it'll be fine, and then you add the underscore in, and all of a sudden they go to a completely new space. Mm-hmm. Now, in film, they don't have that. The acting's all done, so I'm just writing something that goes underneath that. And also the timing is fixed. If I know this speech is going to take exactly 1 minute 13, I will write exactly 1 minute 13's worth of music. A live actor, one day it will be 1 minute 10, the next day it will be 1 minute 20. So I have to build music cues and sound cues that track the actor. So I'm actually chasing them. If they change their timing, I have to be able to change my timing as well.
Rather than back engineering something that's already set in
right.
stone.
Right, yeah, because it's not
film.
Set. That's the difference between live theater and film. Live theater, you never know what you're going to get from day to day.
That's kind of fun. There's some risk
and
there.
And nerve-wracking, yeah.
Now, sound design encompasses, we've talked a lot about music and composition, but sound design encompasses a lot more than something you could leave the theater humming the motif
yes.
of. And it's one of those things where lots of times, unless you happen to be in the field or you go to a lot of live theater, you might leave a performance thinking, gosh, that was really cool, but not being able to identify that sound design was part of what was cool about it. It's almost invisible.
Yeah, we have a joke saying that if a review mentions sound, you probably didn't do your job well. Because the idea is that we're more work on more of a subliminal level. If the phone rings, well, that you're aware of, but you may not be aware of the subtle ambiance of, say, the birds singing in the background during an outdoor scene, or the background walla at a bar scene, or the very subtle music creeping in under a very emotional scene.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that we're heightening the effect of what the actors are doing. We're not trying to draw attention to ourselves.
there has to be a whole vocabulary describing some of these different moments that you know, we in the general public don't speak. For example,
right.
One of the best I've seen a lot of productions of The Crucible. I used to be a high school English teacher, so of course I've seen a lot of productions of The Crucible. One of the best productions I saw was at Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park. And as the audience entered, long before the play started, this started half an hour before curtain, there was a pedal point that you didn't really notice at the beginning. But as you sat there, you started feeling tense, and you started feeling this nameless angst.
Right.
And that continued through the sound design of the whole play, and it was just fascinating. And I wish I could describe it, but I don't have that vocabulary.
Right. Well, that's taking advantage of your subliminal senses. We try to sort of creep in right at the edge of your consciousness. So we're not really distracting you from what the actors are saying, but at the same time, we are affecting your emotions. Yeah, that pedal trick we actually just used this year down at Bloomington at IU in Angels in America. We had some very large subwoofers in the system, which gradually got louder as scenes went on. So you weren't really aware of what was going on, but you noticed eventually that you were shaking a little bit.
Ooh, cool. Do you find yourself being an amateur psychologist then?
All the time.
Really?
Well, both for manipulating the audience. I mean, essentially, you're trying to manipulate people's emotions.
Sure.
Sometimes very consciously, sometimes very subconsciously. But also, I do a lot of voiceover recording and recording sessions with musicians. And again, you're sort of the amateur psychologist telling the actor, well, you know, this character just went through this moment. Maybe you ought to try emoting this way, or maybe you ought to try doing it that way. Or for the performer, this is a very tense, poignant moment. This is what's going on. See if you can adjust your performance to reflect that.
Does that ever make you ambitious to be a director of the whole thing?
No.
You like your niche. You didn't
hesitate
for that.
No. I like being behind the scenes.
What is it like to be a sound designer out in a normal day? Are you super conscious of the noises around you? Do you ever stop and think, oh, wow, I need to remember this? Do you have a system of annotation? Do you carry a tape deck with you?
I think maybe I am a little more conscious. I always have my students keep a log of sounds they hear. I'll say, go to the coffee shop and write down every sound you hear over a 20-minute period.
Wow.
So, but the idea is
just
when you're breaking down.
Aware.
Yeah, become very aware. It breaks down your environment. So I do that a lot. I do not carry a tape recorder, but I spend a lot of time listening to other things other people produce and saying, a little more EQ on that would be nice, or some reverb, or, ooh, I really like how they did that. I have to remember that. I watch a lot of movies, so I'm always storing stuff away when I watch them.
Hmm. You are part of a new venture this summer. Talk about this new theater festival. Where'd this idea come from?
I'm sound designing the first production for the Indiana Festival Theater down in Bloomington, Indiana. The Indiana Festival Theater began this year as a replacement for the Brown County Playhouse, which, as a lot of us know, is the oldest professional theater in Indiana. I believe it operated for 70 years, but finally, due to changes in the economy, decided it was time to move on to greener Elysian Fields, shall we say.
There we go.
And so it has been replaced by the Indiana Festival Theater, which is produced by the Indiana University Department of Theater and Drama as part of our desire to always have a professional theater organization attached to the theater department. This summer, we are doing three shows. It's our inaugural season. We are going to do The Music Man and Comedy of Errors and Ah Wilderness. So I will deal with the first one and then hand it off to my students for the next two.
How does a sound designer work on a musical? What are the limits of your responsibilities there?
Well, my main job is to make sure everybody's heard. You want the actors. I always say, I don't want people to know I'm doing my job. I want them to think, boy, those actors can sing. Not making it obvious that they're wearing microphones and we're subtly boosting their voice. Basically, my job is to facilitate the vision of the director. If he wants an actor way in the back of the room where you could normally not be able to hear him, he needs to be able to hear them. He needs it to be clean. He needs the actors to be able to hear each other. He needs the orchestra to hear the actors. He needs the actors to hear the orchestra. And he needs the audience to hear everything. And it's my job to make that happen. So it's much more of a technical problem than it is an aesthetic problem.
Hmm. What's the most fun thing you've ever done sound design for?
That's a good question. Well, Christmas Carol at Indiana Rep is always one of my favorites, and it's a combination of I get to write the music, I get to create all the sound effects, I design the sound system, but also having worked in Indiana for 14 years now, most of the actors and the directors and other designers are friends of mine. So it's really, it's kind of like coming home.
Aww.
I was actually on staff, at Indiana Rep for 5 years before I moved on. So it really is kind of, you know, like a homecoming. Yeah. So that's always a lot of fun.
What's the strangest thing you've ever been asked to design?
Strangest thing?
Yeah. Maybe it hasn't happened yet.
Well, I'm sure there will be stranger things out in the real world. I don't even think I can answer that because I actually don't know. I think my benchmark of strange and other people's might be different. I do remember smashing up vegetables to simulate the sounds of breaking bones and splitting a skull once. If you hit a melon with a hammer, it sounds what you might imagine somebody's head being split open might sound like.
Sharon Gamble with sound designer Andrew Hobson. We've been listening to his work.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Duke Tomato has been an Indianapolis music staple for several decades. He blends blues with a dash of rock and humorous storytelling with serious musicianship. He also has a new album called I Just Want to Be Rich on Electro Glide Records. Matthew Sosi spoke with Dr. Duke Tomato, and keyboardist James Hill about the new album and the reunion of Tomato and Hill.
So, gentlemen, I just want to be rich. This autobiographical?
Of course. Of course.
It hasn't happened yet?
Well...
You're rich in talent.
There's this story I tell. I've been rich, actually made a whole lot of money in my life, and unfortunately I was not that diligent about keeping it several times, so...
It sounds like a Jimmy Buffett lyric, which we can't repeat here on the air.
Okay.
Now, Duke, were these songs that you had written in... I know there's a couple of older tunes that we've revisited, but I'll get to those. But the current crop of new songs, were these... it's not a concept album, but were these songs that you had written at a specific amount of time, or was there something out of the old box that you wanted to share?
Well, obviously there's I think three songs that I revisited on the thing. Barbecue and Long-Legged Women and Blues Guitar and... what was the third one? The Traveler, which had been a version of it. And The Traveler, obviously, I had rewritten stuff for, the instrumental tune. I had rewritten another part to it, so I did it. Plus, well, the ensemble, it was just going to be fun to do, so I did it. Barbecue, I had always wanted to do it in a more open sense, an acoustic version of it, and just expand it some, and that was it. Long-Legged Women Blues Guitar just rocks, and I never thought it got all the attention that it rightfully deserved. The rest of the stuff, in fact, I did write. I put myself on a schedule and wrote it all within a span of about 6 months. There's an interesting thing about the album, rather personal note. My wife said to me, "You never write songs about me." And I said, "I always write. All I do is write songs about you."
You mean Tie You Up isn't about her?
Well, that was actually before we knew her. But so I started going through the lyrics for her, and she goes, "You shouldn't tell that people all that stuff about us." Like, you know, she's very sweet, but it was.
You have a very patient spouse too.
That's, yes, I do. I'm a lucky man.
Yes, we should be so lucky.
Yeah.
So what? Right on Rhythm is also autobiographical. Bionic Tomato, I know.
Bionic Tomato, of course. Bionic Tomato. Have you ever heard the whole story of that?
No, that's the way I'll ask you.
Bionic Tomato, actually, I did write that a number of years ago, and Jim Hill, who's with us, we still had the All Star Frogs. The original version of Bionic Tomato was absolutely a drug song. It was a cocaine inspired song. Till the powder wears away, replaced now by cosmic rays. But the premise was essentially the same kind of thing.
So it was not a love song to Lindsay Wagner.
No, okay. I think it was before Lindsay Wagner was born. We used to do a bit too, where one of the road guys would come out with a giant mirror with the talcum powder on it or something, right? You know, and I'd go, and blow
like
it in the crowd.
Woody Allen and Annie
people,
Hall,
and
right.
People would just go crazy, you know, just go, oh, God, oh, God.
They'd rush the stage.
Yeah. So this is your version of Champagne and Reefer, because yeah. Buddy, Bob Margolin told me the story that, well, they wouldn't throw bottles up on the stage, but they throw other things.
Yeah, baby.
Anyway.
Well, that's another thing, too, you know. Yeah, people always want to. Everybody thinks if you're playing, enjoying it, and into it, they want to give you something.
I have seen you handle. You're one of the best handlers of fans, you know, in between sets, because you always get the. I saw you in fill in the year, usually with a 19 in it, and
sometimes with an 18.
And they're very telling, and yeah, at times very, very generous, and you handle it. Very, very well.
Well, I've learned over the years that it makes more sense. Plus, I'm grateful. I really am grateful for the recognition and the shared events with them. I mean, sometimes I can't. I don't understand the depth of their experiences compared to me. You know, I'm performing. I've been very blessed to perform as long as I have, and had wonderful shows, wonderful places, and all kinds of great things. You know, and I appreciate the fact that they have this. You know, this one focused memory. I don't share it with them.
Right.
But not necessarily. Because I don't want to.
Right, but sometimes it takes about two or three tellings to remind them of that.
Well, you know, there's a whole litany of things that go along with that perception, too, that through the years thing. It's kind of funny. Now I actually have like four generations of people to come to see us. So.
Wow.
It's pretty neat.
Have you had like families?
Yeah.
Really?
Father, you know, father, son, grandfather, father, son.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And they all want to buy you a shot.
Yeah. Well, and I don't turn them down. I'm a team player.
And you have one good one left.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Now, that definitely is autobiographical.
It's like Clint Eastwood in Gran Torino, I think.
There's some of that in every father. You know, there really is.
Yeah, I'm waiting for that. Now,
you'll get it, my friend.
It's sooner than I think, maybe.
I think you have gray hair now.
I've had gray hair, but it's not like Duke's, of course. But, yeah, it's coming along. Now, you mentioned a couple of songs that you revisited, and one that I was really thrilled with is Barbecue, because I remember that from I Like My Job. Mm-hmm. But also the fact that for some old school folk, you mentioned Zeb's.
Oh, yeah.
The old great barbecue at 38th and Keystone that is tragically not here anymore.
Actually, another interesting aspect of that was like the place that my wife and I went pretty much on our first date.
So, really?
Yeah.
Oh, tell us.
Oh, no, that's enough. That's enough. When she hears this, she'll be already ticked off that I went through the first part of that interview. So,
is there a Zeb story you can tell us? Because that was a staple in my college days.
We just loved the place. We always went down there. And when our kids were little, we used to take them down there, you know. And there was always the I grew up on the south side of Chicago, so the ambiance that was there was quite comfortable to me and very alien to anything they'd see. You know, in the way things are these days, and we'd sit down there and eat the chest pie and
rib tips with mambo sauce, yep, and the great jukebox.
Oh yeah, and the one gal that worked there that looked like she was angry all the time, but just made the best chicken, just killer chicken.
Well, you know, customer service is one thing, and great food is another. Yeah, so. Now you're with this album, you are on Electric Glide Records.
Yeah,
so how did that come about, and how's the relationship been so far?
It's been great. Electric Glide is a relatively new label, and they've just done a lot, and they're more of an internet based operation than we have ever had before. You know, internet presence, and it's really been quite interesting to see the way that pans out, and it's. Very motivated people, you know, very into trying to get all this stuff in the right places, and it's already available overseas, and so it's, you know, everything's moving along at a nice pace. I guess I should mention this too, the song "I Just Want to Be Rich." My daughter, Soraya, who lives in New York, had a punk polka band.
Really?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
What were they called?
Polka Finger.
Well, thank you for saying that clearly.
Yes, I know. I have some radio experience.
Yes.
And I originally wrote it for her. The original version of it was much more raucous and much more, a different attitude to it. And then as I played it through the years, I kind of like came around to this thing, and I really got to enjoy it. So it was then, actually, in the live show, there's a long. not a long, it was a dissertation about being rich and what I would do and that kind of thing. So it's kind of, it's one of those Duke Tomato avenues to express yourself.
That's one. That's for live experience, folks. You have to go on. So James, do you have to wear an accordion for that song?
James does play accordion, though.
Well, come on, Buckwheat. Clifton. Those are Zydeco guys, folks. I'm not
I think it might have been better. That was not Buckwheat. Yeah,
Buckwheat.
What you talking about, Willis? No. Can't answer the question.
That's the voice of James Mitchell Hill.
So, and we'll get to James in just a second. With you also have, before this, you had released Volume 2 of your greatest hits on Sweet Finger Music. So how was the selection process on picking out Volume 2?
Well, there had been a bunch of stuff that had been recorded since Volume 1, which came out in 1996. Mm-hmm. And there had been some other stuff that had come to the fore that from albums that were done after that, and also there had been one tune two tunes that kind of slipped through the cracks before the people were adamant about wanting to have it reissued in a collection, one which was Blues with a Feeling. And so it was more or less what was called for by the crowd and what fans were wanted to have together in a group. So.
And notes from James.
James. No, he tells me directly. He's not a shy man.
So, and speaking of, welcome back, because you recently, Dan Holmes, Indy's lost as Texas' mm-hmm. gain.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one way of putting it.
Yes, good luck, Dan.
Yes. And James, you're back. This is your, how many times have you been with this man?
Oh, God, too many to count.
And you keep coming back.
Well, you know, they gave him Nicorette and it didn't work.
I'm very happy to be back.
And say, and because when you have a new lineup or a current lineup change, that adds a little more dynamic. I know you also do vocals as well. How often do you get to share the mic?
Once, twice, three times, maybe.
A lady.
Yeah.
You know, when I get tired.
Yeah. Or somebody wants to give you a drink or
something. Yeah. There's
Now, as far as touring the Midwest, I check your schedule every week for other show purposes, and it seems like even with the economy or what have you, you're still able to go out and gig within the 500-600 mile radius.
Yeah, we are able to. And now again with this album, we're doing an East Coast run in May. So
really.
Yeah, and we'll probably do a Canadian run, and you know, it's just when there's something to promote and there's something that makes sense, and you can get publicity going. It makes a lot of sense to do that stuff. But other than that, you know, it's really quite convenient to live within tour an area, you can get back home. You know, mm-hmm. It cuts down on costs. The traveling has gotten so much more expensive than it used to be for a band. You know, and the intriguing thing is that the weeknight work is not where you're in place, so you have to get anchor dates and then try to do the best you can to get support, you know, to get there. So, yeah, I'm in a really wonderful position, and having a large fan base in a quarter of the country or a third of the country. So.
And multi-generational fan base.
Yes, yes.
So coming in.
Yeah, and it's, we actually are doing more this year than we did last, and last year we did more than we did the year before. I was kind of pulling off what I had done because I had other commitments that were in place. But as the landscape changes, you adjust to what's going on, and the opportunities there for us to do what we need to do.
Matt Soucy with Duke Tomato and James Hill. Duke Tomato's album, I Just Want to Be Rich, is available on Electro Glide Records and at duketomato.com. That's duketomato.com. He'll be performing at the Indiana Live Casino in Shelbyville this weekend and at the Pensy Art Festival in Greenfield on June 25th. Here's some music from the album, I Just Want to Be Rich.
Grab my money, run down the street to that place that I love to eat. Barbecue, yeah. Barbecue. Extra hot, how I love the hate. Splash that sauce all over my shirt.
Cue birthday singers. Happy birthday to you.
Where are the candles?
I was afraid they'd they might set off.
We'll just take some cupcakes and cakes and stuff. Happy birthday, Sharon!
I have the cupcakes right here. It's our birthday month, and
yours
is just hours away.
Mine is coming up very soon, and yours is coming up a little bit later
this month.
So it's not a happy birthday for Are the Matter. It's just for Sharon and Travis.
That's right.
Okay. So
so send chocolate.
So things that we're going to do on our birthdays to celebrate. Right. That's a good theme for this week's Calendar Week All.
What do we do for our June birthdays? Well, I am a gardener, and I am going to go to the 16th Annual Garden Walk. It is put on by the Indianapolis Garden Club, and it's coming up on Wednesday, which is June 8th, from 9 until 3. If you're not familiar with this, it's really cool. Instead of a garden tour in a single neighborhood, it's a little bit like a tour of the city, and you get to see beautiful private gardens located around one side of the city. You purchase your tickets, and then you'll be sent the addresses of the places you're going to go. And you also have a chance, they always do a garden walk and lunch option as well as just the garden walk. You can get more information at IGCGardenWalk.com. That stands for Indianapolis Garden Club. So IGCGardenWalk.com, and find out more about that.
Very cool. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, for my birthday, you know I love magic, so I'm going to be going to see Jeff McBride. Taylor Martin, as part of Indie Magic Monthly, is bringing in Jeff McBride, who's a great magician from Vegas, and he is going to be doing a full 90-minute show at Theater on the Square this weekend, June 4th. Tickets are still available at the door. You need to get there around 7. There'll be some lobby magic, and then seating begins at 7:15. This is a really great experience because this is a huge big time magician who does wonderful stuff with both mentalism and illusions and table magic, all types of stuff, but in a very small venue. It's a very rare opportunity to get to see him, and he's also going to be doing some lectures and other things. If you go to indiemagicmonthly.com, you can get all the information, or just show up at Theater on the Square Saturday night at 7.
And you won't be made to disappear.
And you will not be made to disappear.
Hey, speaking of birthdays, Carmel Community Players is getting ready to open a musical comedy called Suds, which is a humorous look at the unhappy birthday of a laundromat worker, get it? Using more than 50 songs from the early 60s to help tell the story. It's family-friendly, appropriate for your younger children, and it opens on June 9th and runs through the 19th at the Carmel Community Playhouse, which is in Clay Terrace. So you can Google that and get a little bit more information whether or not it's your birthday.
Very good. Something else I am doing for my birthday, Sharon, going to see Cirque de la Symphony at the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. This is next weekend, and it's part of their pop series, and it's a combination of classical music with circus performers at the Hilbert Circle Theater. Very, very cool. Strongmen and trapeze work and all types of stuff, even like, you know, hanging above the audience at the Circle Theater. And this is taking place next weekend, June 10th, 11th, and 12th.
Notice they're hanging above the audience and not above the expensive instruments on stage.
Good point.
Insurance policies are pretty explicit about that. I'm just sure of it. You know, it's surprisingly easy to make a birthday-themed What'll We Do calendar. Brenda Williams is doing a one-woman show. This is part of what she's been doing with her Creative Renewal Fellowship. She is exploring the idea that while everyone gets older, get it, birthdays, you can still be young at heart. And she's put together this cabaret show using favorites from American popular music. And it's coming up one night only. It's Friday, June 17th at 8 o'clock at the Cabaret at the Columbia Club. You can find out more and get your tickets at thecabaret.org, thecabaret.org.
That is going to be a super fun show.
Absolutely. She's great.
Definitely looking forward to that. Hey, there's a lot of great art openings this weekend, of course. First Friday on Friday night, and then other galleries having great openings all weekend long, including new work at the Gallery 924, which is the gallery that the the Arts Council of Indianapolis runs. Great gallery there. And they're presenting Hector Rene Del Campo, and Ventanas is the name of the show. And he's a Cuban-American artist, and some really beautiful work that I've seen some reproductions of. Looking forward to see that show. Also, IMOCA is having their opening with a show called My Son, the Future Time Traveler. I just love the title of that. And that's taking place down at Fountain Square, featuring Cincinnati artist Ryan Mulligan's work.
That is very cool. Speaking of anniversaries of things,
yes.
Glory June Greif has a photo exhibition that just opened at the Plainfield Public Library. It is Selected Wonder, or Selected Photos, over 30 years. That's her phrase for it, Selected Wonder, over 30 years. The overall title of the show is Stop, Look, See, and it features photos from Neon in the Night and Other Roadside Joys, Flow 1 and Flow 2, Look, Wonders at Your Feet, and Look Up, Architectural Details and Delights. And she has such a fascinating background. Yeah. Among other things, she's an architectural historian. And that display, that photo exhibit, is on display through the month of June at the Plainfield Public Library.
Very cool. Hey, some shows going on next week, and also just to remind people about Talbot Street, of course, is going on Saturday and Sunday, and then also the Heron Center for the Arts annual Independent Music and Art Festival is taking place on Saturday the 11th, and that starts at 11 a.m. and goes till 5 p.m. that day.
If you're hearing us on Friday night, you might want to set your alarm and get up early, because isn't this Saturday the Woodruff Place Flea Market?
That's right. Saturday and Sunday, Woodruff Place Flea Market going on this weekend.
If you find yourself short of fleas.
Well, there you go.
Hey, if your kids are getting in your hair, you might want to think about a camp for them. Exploring Nature is one of the camps. History Alive is another of the camps. Those are coming up, and the deadline for registration on both coming up as well, at the Indiana State Museum. You can find out more at the Indiana State Museum's website.
Cool. Last thing I've got, if you're looking for some great gifts, of course, the summer series at the Palladium. The tickets for that have just been announced. Indigo Girls, Lyle Lovett, Emmylou Harris. She gives a great concert. Pat Benatar and Martin Short. I mean, how fun is that up at the Palladium? Those will be great shows.
I love that. I know. I'm so excited. I have tickets already. Festival of the Americas, my last item, next Saturday at 3 o'clock, the Indianapolis Children's Choir hosting several of the finest children's choirs around, coming together to celebrate the music of North, Central, and South America. And that's all going on at Clues Memorial Hall on Saturday the 11th at 3 o'clock.
Very cool. Great. Well, we'll be back next week with more birthday ideas and other things to do to celebrate the arts on that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
The Children's Museum of Indianapolis is opening a new exhibit June 11th called National Geographic Treasures of the Earth. Well, actually, it's three new exhibits, including an Egyptian tomb, a pirate shipwreck, and some ancient Chinese warriors. Travis DiNicola spoke with the museum's president and CEO, Jeffrey Patchen, about this new permanent exhibit and partnership.
Jeff, welcome to our studio. It's great to see you here in person today. I think the last time we talked was by phone, and you were on a boat on the Nile.
2 years ago.
Two years ago.
We were scheduled to go to take a group, our second group of family, family travelers over to Egypt on March 27th, obviously that was canceled due to all the unrest there.
Things have changed a bit.
Yeah, they certainly have.
Well, you have, so 2 years ago, you were on the Nile, and we were chatting about this very exhibit that's going to be opening in June. This has got to be so exciting. I know you've been working on the National Geographic exhibit in partnership for quite a while. Where would you like to start in talking
about
it?
The partnership with National Geographic has just been just the best to partner with. The relationship goes back almost 7 years when we conceived of an exhibit about maps, because kids and families need to know where they are and where we've come from and all of that. So we developed this traveling exhibit called National Geographic Maps, Tools for Adventure. Mm-hmm. And part of what National Geographic contributed was a focus on six National Geographic explorers, of which Dr. Zahi Hawass, who's chair of the Supreme Council of Antiquities in Egypt, was one, and led us to a whole series of relationships related to everything from helping to design a new children's museum in Cairo to the content for this exhibit, which focuses on this incredible tomb of the Pharaoh Seti I, one of the most beautiful and glorious tombs in the Valley of the Kings. And it's just, of course, National Geographic is that incredible treasure trove of photography and images of the world.
Now, you know, of course, this is incredibly educational, and kids are going to love it. But I must say, I mean, it seems like more of the type of an exhibit that, you know, a history museum or a science museum or, you know, or even the Metropolitan Museum of Art would have as opposed to a children's museum.
Well, thank you for recognizing that. We work very hard at an approach that we call family learning.
Mm-hmm.
That even though our name is the Children's Museum of Indianapolis, there is just as much for adults as there is for children. And
certainly,
necessarily, when we create these large permanent spaces, like we are with National Geographic, we want to engage the entire family. And mm-hmm. so there'll be lots of information and activities for adults as well as, of course, for children and youth.
Very good. Now, and this is a permanent exhibit.
It
not
is.
Just a traveling or touring or temporary piece. Right. Where in the Children's Museum is it going to be physically located?
This will be actually in two levels. The lower level, and our visitors may and friends may remember a gallery called What If that mm-hmm. actually had a mummy in it for a period long period of time and some dinosaurs and underwater kind of thing. And the level just above that, in level one, which mm-hmm. we've created kind of an overlook into the gallery space,
okay.
and a special new elevator, new lift, that will actually take visitors from the second floor down to the lower
oh,
level
very good.
In a kind of a themed descent experience.
Okay, and this is on the right. Is that correct? When you walk into the
yes,
lobby,
yes, it
okay.
is. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm just trying to sort of picture where it all is. Now there's three major exhibits that are part of the National Geographic Treasures of the Earth. Tell me a little bit about each one, if you would.
Well, we wanted to cover the idea was archaeology, and mm-hmm. we know from Dinosphere that kids just love paleontology and they love digging and all of that kind
oh, yeah.
of thing, and everybody kind of has these mysteries around legendary fiction and sometimes nonfiction characters like
Indiana
Jones, right?
Of course, right.
So,
mm-hmm.
And quest for things unfound and the mysteries of the past. And so we really wanted to spend mm-hmm. some time delving into archaeology. And so we selected three incredible excavations, even though they were discovered in the two of them discovered quite a while ago in
okay.
the past, are revealing new science. In the case of the tomb of Seti I, there's new information about a shaft leading into this tomb.
Hmm.
And so visitors will have an opportunity to figure out where does that shaft lead and what
okay.
are the clues along the way that might tell us about whose tomb is at the end. The second is the Terracotta Warriors of Xi'an, which
mm-hmm.
were discovered in the mid-70s by a farmer digging for water for
mm-hmm.
a well, and discovered these thousands of terracotta soldiers from the Emperor Qin dynasty. And, of course, the new science there is that they've discovered that these were not plain gray brown figures as we've come to see them in all
right,
the pictures
right.
but they were very brightly painted from some new research about the chemicals that have been discovered
and
on,
each one's
on them.
Completely different.
Each one right. has some features that are unique
yeah.
and different, mostly the facial features, and
okay.
there were even some variations in the paint which are
yeah.
very interesting. And then the third is a more recent find
mm-hmm.
by underwater archaeologist right here in our own state, Professor Charlie Beaker from Indiana University, who found the shipwreck of Captain Kidd the pirate in
oh, cool.
10 feet of water in the Dominican Republic, and is turning that excavation site into an underwater park, which we are dedicating next week with Charlie in the Dominican Republic. It's
wow.
very exciting.
Now on that one, how does something in 10 feet of water go undiscovered for so long?
Well, it's an interesting story. It is actually 20 minutes away from
uh-huh.
the coast of the Dominican Republic on a just literally 10 or 15 feet
okay.
off a coral shelf, which is on a little tiny island called Catalina. It's not the Catalina in California.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Catalina mm-hmm. off the coast of the Dominican Republic. And the what happened was that Kidd's ship was offloaded on the mainland, set ablaze, left the cannon in it,
Okay.
And it floated across, sailed across on its own until it bumped into this island of Catalina and sank ablaze.
Mm-hmm.
And the cannon just remained in this pile. And, of course, over the years, it was 1699, I think, when it sank. Over the years, became encrusted with coral and the like. And then a local diver found it and reported it. And the government, along with Charlie, kind of...
Eventually, they sort of realized what it was.
And Charlie's been able to confirm the kid that was kid's ship because he found some teak wood at the site, and the teak wood was joined in a way called a rabbit joint that he had never seen before, and there was only one shipbuilder in that time period in India, and he traced this back to. Various historical journals, et cetera, to a family that was building teak ships in that particular time period in India. He traveled over to India.
Wow.
The same family is in the business.
Still.
It has the records of that family business today.
Huh.
It's just magic of the past that, you know, you never know where the mysteries are and how close to human history today the past is.
Yeah, wow, that's just fascinating. Now, with the kid ship, you'll have on display the cannon, is that
we
correct?
Have it on display. Okay. We will have it on display. It's in the museum now in a very special large tank, and we'll now be one of the three sites for conservation of artifacts from the Dominican Republic. There's a wet lab that the Dominican Republic government has. There's one that Charlie has at IU. And now we'll be the third to have a functioning wet lab, which will begin to expose these pieces by removing all of the encrustation and barnacles and corals and all of that. Right. So
it's in water. I mean, that's
in fresh water with a chemical process and electricity called electrolytic reduction.
Wow.
And over that over a time period of about 2 years, our visitors will be able to see this cannon shape becoming clearer and clearer and clearer.
Oh, how neat.
Matter of fact, Charlie's had it, I think, for almost 8 months or a year now, and there is an insignia that has revealed itself on the side of the cannon, which again further confirms where it was made, et cetera, et cetera. So
excellent.
It's very exciting.
That's very cool. I mean, reasons certainly to keep going back and seeing how that
absolutely
evolves.
And we just received this incredible grant from the Lilly Company Foundation for a series of additional expeditions for the Kara Merchant for kidship. One for a 1725 Spanish galleon that Charlie has found called the Begonia, which was found in 3 feet of sand and water not far from the runway at the Santo Domingo Airport. And the third ship he's looking for, and he believes he has some strong indication of maybe present, is one of the lost fleet of Columbus.
Wow.
Which is just so exciting
to
have
a children's
museum engaged in this with National Geographic and Charlie just makes this all come alive for children and families.
I mean, did you ever imagine when you got into the business of children's museums that you'd be doing this type of work? I mean, this is
This is what and I think most of the staff in the museum and the board and volunteers as well. We think the best stories are the true ones, and so that's why we promote real humanities, real arts, real sciences, and trying to bring the real stories of the past to life for children and families versus fictional kinds of things.
So. Now I did mention, of course, that the cannon is a real artifact.
I
do want to be clear that with the Terracotta Warriors, these are recreations.
These are replicas, right?
Replicas, okay. And and then there's sort of a combination of both with the Tomb of Seti?
Absolutely. We have some objects from Seti's tomb. We have some Shabtis and some other small pieces on loan from the British Museum and a number of other locations that will be on display and then rotated out and other objects brought in of that particular time period. We're working hard with the Shaanxi Regional Provincial Government in Xi'an to bring some real terracotta warriors here in the future, which we think will be very exciting as well.
Wow, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
How very neat. Congratulations on
Thank
all
you.
This. Yeah, it's just great stuff, which leads me to a question that a friend of mine asked me the other day. And he said, you know, I love the Children's Museum, but do you think they would ever consider having an adults-only night just to for all the adults who want to see this stuff, who maybe don't have kids, who don't want to...
Well, you know, it's funny when we do tours for adults and they say, you know, this place would be a lot of fun if there just weren't so many kids around. And we kind of laugh, you know, but...
of course.
We do have, of course, behind the scenes and some tours and things like that for adults. But that's a good idea, Travis. We need to take back and see if maybe once in a while we could do an adults-only evening or something like that.
Or maybe a rent-a-kid thing for,
there
for those
you
of
go.
Us who don't have kids.
There
you want to, you know, take some there. Now, of course, Jeff, while I got you here, just briefly, you've got a lot of other great exhibits there, fun things going on this summer. Anything else you'd like to share with us?
You know, it'll be an exciting summer with National Geographic. It opens June 11th. Mm-hmm. There's a gala on June 4th for anyone that would like to attend. Just let the museum know. And in the fall, we're bringing in a very exciting exhibit called Frogs.
Okay.
Which is hundreds of live frogs
cool.
and a frog handler with them. From the smallest little tiny tree frog to the big cane toads. And it's very, very exciting. And then, of course, the haunted house.
Of course.
Which is always, always fun. Mm-hmm. And then Jolly Days, which follows that as
sure,
well.
Sure, of course. And all the other great things, the Big Chihuly piece. And
the Big Chihuly piece, and we've still have
areas.
Dora and Diego. Mm-hmm. That's a traveling exhibit that we put together with Nickelodeon that will be here for a bit longer, and then we'll go on tour.
Very good, very good. Jeff, a pleasure to chat with you. And,
thank you, Travis.
Again, congratulations on
Thank
these
you.
Great exhibits. I can't wait to see them.
Travis DiNicola with Jeffrey Patchen, President and CEO of the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. The exhibit National Geographic Treasures of the Earth opens at the Children's Museum of Indianapolis on June 11th. More information at childrensmuseum.org, childrensmuseum.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4 when I'll get a preview of what the Festival Music Society is offering this summer. And I'll also learn about a new musical based on the life of Hans Christian Andersen.
And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting its inaugural season through June. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.